the 47th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 15th of November 1977, Brother John Knowles speaking to the subject, The Resurrection of First Fruits and the Millennial Reign of Christ, and the reading, Revelation chapter 20.
Hymn 127. Commencing the study, we'll call on our brother John to give us the bulletin this week in Israel.
Well, by far the most interesting news, of course, is the very current news in relationship to the activities between Egypt and Israel. And one is very much reminded of the words in Daniel chapter 11, which in the concluding verses there speak of the onslaught of the king of the north into the land of Israel and makes specific mention of Egypt. And the context of it would seem to indicate that at the time that the king of the north comes down, that Egypt is certainly not favourably disposed towards Russia, nor vice versa. For we read there that in verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, which implies, very clearly states in fact, an invasion of that country. And then goes on to say, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. So that's the situation as we see it today, that Russian wealth has built up Egypt. I know Western money's been poured in too, but for things like the Aswan Dam and other activities like that, it's been Russian money. And so we're seeing in the last few days a movement of Egypt towards having direct talks with Israel. It has been too recent to come out in any of the available Israeli publications as at this date, but I understand tonight that there was some very enterprising media personality in America managed to phone up President Sadat and also Menachem Begin, and has got President Sadat to agree that he would go as soon as next week to Jerusalem to actually address the Knesset. In fact, he says that's what he wants to do. One doesn't know whether it will come off, or what he will say if he gets there, or what effect it will have. But it is an interesting thing that Egypt is prepared to step aside from the Arab League. When asked what did he think the rest of the Arab countries would feel about it, he said he hadn't discussed it with them. And so this is Egypt's stand at the moment, and it could well be the forerunner to a split in the Arab ranks, with Syria possibly going more towards Russia, and Egypt moving more towards the West, and even maybe having a softer line with Israel. As far as our ongoing saga of the Geneva talks, are they on or are they not on? Currently they're not on, and it's the Arabs who don't want them this time, because the US-Israel agreement, which you remember it was all about the 242 and 338 and all these Security Council resolutions and UN Council resolutions, the Arabs find they are too restrictive now, and they won't go along and talk unless the Palestine Liberation Organization can go there, unless they're prepared to talk about a Palestinian state and all of these things. So it's very interesting, but Egypt is by far the most interesting in that particular setup. It's also, again, interesting to note that Somalia is now becoming disenchanted with Russia. Somalia and Ethiopia were at loggerheads, and both were favourably disposed towards Russia, both getting Russian arms, which we thought was rather intriguing. But of course we know here that it's going to be Libya and Ethiopia who's going to be at Russia's steps. And so Somalia is now bowing out, leaving Ethiopia friendly with Russia, and of course Libya also. So in fact in North Africa now, the two nations which are friendly disposed towards Russia are Ethiopia and Libya, as it should be, and Egypt moving away from Russia, and maybe even prepared to make some sort of an agreement with Israel. It certainly fits in perfectly with what we expect to see, and one wonders just how much more we expect to see, or are even going to see, because things are moving on at a rapid rate indeed. On the domestic front, you may recall the elections that we spoke about, must be getting back, how long ago since the election? 7 or 8 months, I suppose. They were precipitated by events late last year, and the elections took place, I think it was to the early part of this year. Well, you remember there was the Democratic Movement for Change, the new party, led by Yigal Yadin, the archaeologist. They scored 12 seats in the Knesset, and Menachem Begin offered them some very important cabinet posts if they were prepared to throw their lot in with the Likud party, which is the governing party. They said no, they couldn't go along with the Likud's attitude towards domestic issues. They felt that the Likud was too hardline, too concerned with outside issues, with foreign affairs, and they felt that they'd have to, you know, to modify their stand a little bit. Well, the DMC have made up their mind at last that they will go along with Likud policy, and Yigal Yadin has been offered the position and has accepted the position of Deputy Prime Minister, which is quite a significant post. And so they are postulating on the possibility of Begin becoming too ill to continue, because he's got a recurring heart condition and is in and out of hospital quite frequently. They are postulating as to whether or not, in fact, this newcomer to politics, Yigal Yadin, would in fact become a prime minister in the near future. That's a matter of internal interest. Certainly, Yadin is a very popular man. Just what his expertise would be as a politician, only time would tell. But certainly Begin has turned out to be extremely popular, and he has united the country together very well. His latest domestic move to float the Israeli pound and let it find its own level was not all that popular. But I think most people are prepared to give it a go, although the union movement is not terribly happy about it at all, and they're threatening all sorts of strikes. Prior to the floating of the Israeli pound, the parity rate was about 10 Israeli pound to the dollar. That's the approximate figure. They floated it, and overnight it went 15 to the dollar, so it devalued by 50%. They had been devaluing at a rate of 2.5% a month. That was a standard devaluation. So Begin's advisor, Ehrlich, suggested that, well, why don't we do it all in one clean sweep and just float the pound and see what happens to it? So it's now gone to about 15 to the dollar, and apparently it's stabilised at that for the last week or so. This means, the papers tell us, that it will now be much cheaper for tourists to go to Israel, if anybody's interested in that. It should mean that Israeli exports are much cheaper, but as Dry Bones pointed out in today's Jerusalem Post, what does that mean for us? Well, it says, in the meantime, we starve. So apparently it's not going to be too good for the Israelis. Oh, you know Dry Bones, that I'm loath to refer to. There was another one they put in, and it was in regard to the releasing of Archbishop Capucci. You know this archbishop who was jailed for 12 years because he was the Greek Catholic archbishop, Greek Catholic or Roman Catholic? Greek Catholic, I think it was. Yeah, Greek Catholic, Archbishop of Jerusalem, who was making frequent trips to Lebanon and stowing guns and that in his car when he came back over the Lebanese border. Well, they caught up with him eventually and jailed him for 12 years. There's been a lot of approaches made to Israel to release him, and the government said, no, we won't let him go unless we get a personal letter from the Pope. So they did. They got a personal letter from the Pope, and they said, all right, we'll let him go. So after serving 3 years, he has been released, and I understand he's going to go to Argentina or Brazil or one of those South American countries. But this week's Dry Bones had a correspondent phoning up from Rome and saying, you know, it's all right for you people in Israel to let Capucci go, but the people in Rome aren't terribly happy because on every street corner they are proudly displaying these signs which read C-A-P-U-C-C-I-N-O, which reads Capucci No. And I thought, oh, a bit weak. You know, I couldn't quite see it until someone pointed out to me that you put the two words together and it spells cappuccino. So, which I thought was very clever. But anyway, the point is that whether it's cappuccino or whether they don't want Capucci to be released, politicians feel that maybe it is a bad move for Israel to release him, because having released him now, it could bring a spate of attacks against Israel. Whilst he was there, they felt that these attacks wouldn't come, verbal attacks perhaps even from the Vatican. So, interesting things happening. The Egyptian situation is the most interesting. The economic situation is getting worse in Israel with the devaluation, and the new party coming into the cabinet could foreshadow interesting domestic changes as well.
We'll now call on Brother Richard Sheikh to read for us Revelation chapter 20.
Reading together, Revelation chapter 20. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads, or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead lived not again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. And when 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth, and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven, and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night for ever and ever. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. And the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every man, according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire.
Thank you, Richard. Now we'll call on Brother John to lead us to the theme, The Resurrection's First Fruit and Christ's Millennium Reign. Brother John.
Because of the nature of the study tonight, and also we've got a somewhat smaller group, I thought we might conduct this a little more informally. In other words, I would welcome any questions at any stage during the night, with my apologies to the tape recordist, but I think there's some things here in Revelation 20 might be new to a number of people. They're certainly in Eureka, but they're only in Eureka if you read it very closely, and some of these points don't seem to be in many of the notes which are currently available. So in the event of you having any questions at any stage, you'd be very welcome to ask them, or to add any comments for that matter if you think you can add to what has been said. So I'm suggesting that we conduct it just a little bit more informally than we have. So what we're going to endeavour to do tonight is to cover the whole of Revelation 20. I don't think that's out of the question of possibility at all. And the other thing is, because of the aspects of Eureka which I'm concerned with, we will be following fairly closely the matter as set out in Eureka Volume 3 from page 663. The translation itself actually starts on page 661, but we will be starting on page 663. So we're going to have a look then at the work of this angel of Revelation 20 and of verse 1, this angel which comes down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and the same angel lays hold on the dragon, that old serpent which is the devil and Satan, and binds him 1,000 years. Now we're going to be looking at this for a few moments to try and work out the significance of these symbols. There are three parties involved in these activities, which are described as the punishment of this sin power, and the three parties are the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon. Now, we've got to get a very clear picture in our mind of the difference between these three groups, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. I did actually make up a list of all the places where these words occur in the apocalypse, but the overhead projector's not available tonight, so I can't project it up to you. But you can get these out of a concordance quite readily. The dragon is the early stage, isn't it, of the Roman system, and you get that particularly in Revelation chapter 12, and then you get it alluded to a little bit after that. The beast comes out in Revelation chapter 13, and again alluded to a few times after that, because the beast is a later stage of this dragon power. And then the false prophet is referred to in only three places. He's referred to in Revelation chapter 16, where the three are put together, and we'll look at that in just a moment. He's referred to in the latter part of Revelation chapter 19, that's in chapter 19 and verse 20, and he's referred to again in chapter 20 and verse 10. So this false prophet is just sort of interspersed. Well, going back to Revelation 16, where we see the three of them put together, we are told that as the preparation for the pouring out of the sixth vial, we're told there that there were three unclean spirits like frogs in verse 13, coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. And we glibly define those three symbols as referring to the dragon, Constantinople, the beast, Central Europe, Germany, Vienna, and the false prophet, Rome. Well, that's very good if we're simply following our somewhat historical prophetic view of the apocalypse, in which we very neatly take a symbol and we very neatly apply it to one particular thing and we say that's it, and every other time we see that symbol we will thereby apply it in the same way, so that every time we see the dragon we will automatically see Constantinople. Well, you know, that's not what we've been trying to do, is it? We've been seeing that, of course, symbols are symbols and they do refer to a certain thing, but it may not always be that same person, or it may not always be manifest in the same way. Now, what's that all got to do with tonight? Well, what it's got to do with tonight, really, is Brother Thomas's opening comment on page 663, which says, "The angel descending from the heaven with the key and chain is the same angel that descends and illuminates the earth with his glory, which was referred to in chapter 18, verse 1. All right, now, that's fairly clear, because the descending angel of chapter 18 is, of course, the saints. It's this multitudinous manifestation. And in chapter 18, this angel is the one which judges Babylon. In fact, that's the next point that he makes. He says, in this place, he is said to have great power, which he exerts in causing Babylon to fall. So there is the destruction of Babylon as being the work of this descending angel. Now he says, after this, in laying hold of the fourth beast of Daniel, in his dragon, beast, and false prophet manifestations, there's a colon there, but we'll stop for the moment. He says he's now going to lay hold of Daniel's fourth beast in his dragon, beast, and false prophet manifestations. Now you remember, they are the three that we saw from Revelation 16. The dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. But he goes on to say, the last two of which, that is the beast and the false prophet, the last two of which he destroys, so that similar political organizations never again appear upon the earth, while the dragon, in consequence of flesh and blood nature, being still the constitution of the subject nations, is only shut up and bound, waiting its opportunity to reassert its independence of the divine government of the saints. Now that's very clear, because that's what Revelation 20 is all about. So his basis for saying that is this. When we look at the concluding verses of Revelation 19, leading up to our chapter tonight, we see in verse 20 that it says, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with whom he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. So they were destroyed. But when we come to chapter 20, we read that the dragon, surnamed the devil and Satan, is not destroyed along with the beast and the false prophet, but is rather chained for 1,000 years, at the end of which time he is loosed and he rebels. Now, how come the dragon isn't destroyed with the beast and the false prophet, when in fact they are all referring to the Roman system? Or at least that's the way we've always referred to them as. And in Revelation chapter 16 we simply say that the dragon is Constantinople, that the beast is Central Germany, and that the false prophet is Rome. How come the false prophet and the beast are destroyed, but the dragon is not? Well, Brother Thomas simply says that the dragon, in consequence of flesh and blood nature, is still the constitution of the subject nations, and is only shut up and bound, waiting its opportunity to reassert its independence of the divine government of the saints. Well, it's a matter then, I think, of getting our understanding of these particular symbols very clear. And I don't really know whether I can put into words what I've got in my mind. I'll try. I suppose one should be able to, but sometimes these symbols are a little bit difficult to differentiate between. Probably the easiest thing to do is to go back to that chart You know, the Kingdom of Men chart, Christadelphian teaching since 1848, it's in the notes. And we see that the dragon was in fact the early stage of the Roman system. The dragon is Revelation chapter 12, and that was the pagan Roman system. Back in the days when Rome was just an ordinary pagan power, there was nothing Christian about it. It was just typical of the flesh. But when we come to the beast stage, which we see is the next stage, the beast of the sea followed by the beast of the earth, we've now got a change in Roman system in which it becomes a Christian power. And a power which became even more abhorrent in the sight of the deity. Because a pagan is a pagan. He doesn't know the truth and therefore he can't accept the truth. But a Christian who supposedly knows the truth but persecutes the true believers and does everything to distort the word, he's in a far worse position than somebody who never knows it and therefore doesn't accept it because he's got nothing to reject. It's never been put before him. So the dragon then represents pagan Rome, sure, but it more particularly represents the base of the whole thing. That was flesh. And Rome back in the days of pagan Rome was just flesh. But when it became the beast, it took on a new aura. It took on this aura of Christianity, and it made it worse. It made it more responsible to God. And of course, as far as the false prophet is concerned, well, he would answer to the eyes and mouth of a man out of Daniel's little horn, which was speaking great blasphemous things. And so the beast then represents the Christian church state system, which whilst it was Roman, was more particularly a religious system which was far more abhorrent in the sight of God than what the dragon stage was, which was just flesh. And of course the false prophet represents the one who promulgates this, not only the Pope himself but also all of his ambassadors, the various priests and cardinals and bishops and so forth. So when you look at it like that, what we've got then is a picture of this. The dragon represents paganism, it represents the flesh in its plain raw state. It represents nations who just don't know the truth. But the beast represents an abhorrent church-state system, and the false prophet represents those who promulgate that. Consequently then, when the Lord Jesus Christ returns, and during that period of the 40 years judgment, it is the beast and the false prophet who are destroyed. In other words, the beast representing the church-state system and the false prophet representing those who promulgate this, they can't go into the kingdom. There's no place for those in the millennial age. But on the other hand, the dragon, representing raw flesh, one might say, just the nations as they were, not knowing the truth, stand as a representative of those people, those nations, who will be prepared to continue on into the millennium, and who at the end of the millennium will manifest the same characteristics as Gog and Magog did before. Not so much a religious opposition, but just plain flesh rebelling. Because when Gog comes down into the land, it's not a religious onslaught, it's just a fleshly aggrandizement which this power desires to manifest. So that's why then, in Revelation 19, we've got the vision there of the beast and the false prophet being destroyed, but not the dragon. It's very similar to what we've got in Daniel 7, and you'll find that right through here, Brother Thomas keeps referring to Daniel 7, because our Kingdom of Men chart also is based on the vision of Daniel chapter 7. And that in Daniel chapter 7, he tells us something very similar. It's not identical, but it's very similar. And that is this, that there were four beasts. The lion representing Babylon, the bear representing Medo-Persia, and the leopard representing Greece, followed by this dreadful and terrible fourth beast representing the Roman system, and particularly manifesting itself as the little horn with the eyes and mouth speaking great blasphemous things. In other words, the false prophet. And also including in it the various heads and horns representing that European state church system. Now, that particular beast, we are told in Daniel chapter 7, and at verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. So because that little horn, that false prophet, spoke these blasphemous words, because of that, he says, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So that Roman Catholic church-state false prophet beast has to have his body given to the burning flame. But as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Now that's equivalent to the dragon being bound with a chain for 1,000 years. We've mentioned this before in our classes, but for those who perhaps weren't here on that occasion, the expression in Daniel 7 and verse 12, which says their lives were prolonged for a season and a time, Brother Thomas points out to us that the word season is a word used in Scripture to represent the period of gestation of a child, the 280-day period. Sarah was told that about this season she would have a child. And so 280 days would be the period answering to a season, as it occurs sometimes in the Scripture. And as far as the word time is concerned, well, a Jewish time or year was 360 days. And the doctor, for reasons which he knows best, so I haven't gone into the Hebrew of it, tells us that it is actually two times which are used here. Consequently, then, we have 360 twice. So 360 plus 360 is 720. And if you add to that the season of 280, you get exactly 1,000. So 1,000 days or 1,000 years is the millennium. So there it is taught in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 12 that there will be certain beasts who will have their dominion taken away, but their lives, their political lives, prolonged for 1,000 years. Now that, in effect, is what we're reading in Revelation chapter 20, that whereas the beast and the false prophet, answering to that Catholic church state false prophet aspect of the Roman system, that will be destroyed. That cannot go into the millennium. Nevertheless, the Roman nation, the nations which come out of Rome, the people themselves, answering to the pagan stage, if you like, answering to the dragon stage, they will have their lives prolonged for a season at a time. Now, I say the similarity is almost identical. Someone might say, well, the difference is this, that the dragon in Revelation was still Roman, whereas here you've got your Roman beast destroyed. Yes, it was Roman, but you know, the dragon phase of Rome was more akin to the Babylonian, Persian, Greek aspect of the kingdom of men than what it was to the later stage of the Roman history, which was Catholic. The great bulk of Roman history has been Christian. The small part where Rome figures in history, which is pagan, is only very small indeed. So in fact, the dragon phase of Rome, whilst we say it is Rome, it's more akin rather to the attributes of the lion, the bear, and the leopard of Daniel 7. So it's the lion, the bear, and the leopard which have their lives prolonged in Daniel 7. But it's the dragon in Revelation that has its life prolonged. So what we're saying then is this, that the beast and the false prophet, their bodies are given to the burning flame, they're destroyed, but the dragon, answering to just the nations who have not been responsible in the sense that the Christian Roman system has been, they will have their lives prolonged either for a season and a time, Daniel 7, or they will be chained for 1,000 years, Revelation 20. Well, no one's asked any questions yet. Admittedly, I haven't given you much chance. Yeah. He says that in Daniel 7 verse 12, their lives were prolonged for a season and two times. He makes it two times. My statement was, I've never checked up on the Hebrew. I haven't found any translations which say two times except Brother Thomas's. But we know he must be right because it does make 1,000 and that's perfect. But don't ask me what Hebrew text he got it from. I have personally great confidence in Brother Thomas's translation. They've always proved to be extremely good, and I feel just as confident that he was right in this one. Regardless of that, however, the answer is right, so he must be right. But it's a season, that is 280, and two times, which is 360 plus 360. 360 days being the number of days in a Jewish year. And for those who aren't familiar with that and wonder what happened to the other 5 1/4 days, well, they caught up with it every now and again by putting in an extra month. So some years they had 13 months, the month was it, Second Ada. You don't know Hebrew. Yeah, that's right, Second Ada, Ve Ada or something. And they throw that in to make up the extra 5 1/4 days for
A soul a year, is that the one that we, 365 and a quarter?
Yeah.
Soul a year, the one that goes round the sun. Yeah. Yes, it's an exposition of Daniel, he deals with it, but he doesn't answer my little problem about what the Hebrew text is. Yes, it's an exposition of Daniel. Now, we had another one over here, I think, Brother McGeorge, didn't we? Were you going to... Did you say... I thought you bleated a few moments ago. Sorry, well, someone did, didn't they? It becomes that way, yes, by the time you get to the end. And I think we're going to see that that Gog and Magog of Revelation 20 is much more closely related to the Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 38 than what we ever imagined. You know, we say it's a sort of a type, but it's more than the type, it's actually the territory is the same. Brother Thomas is going to make that point. So that the dragon was Constantinople. I mean, I was saying that we just sort of glibly made it. But Russia comes down and takes Constantinople, and in taking Constantinople, takes on the dragon mouth, doesn't it? So the answer is, within the context of our study tonight, yes. But I don't want to take it outside of the context of our study tonight, that every time we see dragon, we can say that's Russia. Because, you know, the dragon of Revelation 12 isn't Russia. Is it? That's the pagan Roman system. But in the context of Revelation 20, yes, there we can draw an equal sign between the dragon and the territory of Gog and Magog, particularly at the end of the millennium. Yes, I do feel there's a very definite link up between Ezekiel 39 and those comments of the doctors. You referred to them on page 663, David. Are those ones... Yes, certainly. Yep. It proves to us very definitely, not that we need having it proved to us here in this hall tonight, some certainly do, that flesh does not, under good circumstances, immediately divest itself of all its fleshly qualities, that it can be restrained. But it's not as though there's something inherently good in human nature that when you put it into a good environment will automatically make it good. Because even the millennium proves that at the end of that time, when the restraint is removed, when the chains are taken off, that flesh is just the same as it ever was, unless it's, you know, because this is flesh here, it's not people who have been begotten again from above, that flesh is just the same. There is a theory, of course, which says that during the millennium, that flesh, because it is inherently good, will become better, and therefore there should be no revolt at the end of the millennium. And so they make Revelation chapter 20 actually equivalent to Ezekiel 38, and therefore say that it was fulfilled at the beginning of the millennium and that there will be no post-millennial revolt. And that is believed by some people, that there is no such thing as a post-millennial revolt. It's done on the basis that flesh is not as bad as, quote, you people make it, as I was told once. You people are always talking about how bad flesh is. Why don't you look at the other side of it and see the goodness that's in it? Which I retorted, that is a very dangerous statement. As the brother backed out of the hall, it wasn't in this city, and he said, yes, I know. He said, I know, he said something else, he mumbled in his beard. But the fact is that it is very much related to the doctrine of clean flesh, and certainly can be seen in its ultimate extent to be tied up with clean flesh. And also, of course, it muddles up all of the time setting of the prophecy in Revelation 20. So the fact is that at the end of the millennium, flesh is going to have to be sacrificed once again, because it will still be the same, and it is only then, at the end of the millennium, with that
with flesh completely eradicated, that God can be all in all. So the principles of Ezekiel 39, the sacrifice of flesh, will apply again at the end of the millennium. Well, anything else? Yes, that's right. The consoling feature, of course, is that the Old Testament points out to us that that life will be extended during the millennium, that the converts will doubtless be many more, but there will still be those ones there who refuse to accept. And the point is very true, that that flesh is something that we cannot trust. We can't trust ourselves. It's the sort of thing that you can't just push under. You can't suppress flesh. Well, you can, but that doesn't cure it. You know, the Judaizer under law says, I won't do this, that, and something, other thing. I'll push flesh down. But you just take the lid off the box and out it pops again. And so all you can do to it is sacrifice it. Now, we've got the opportunity to sacrifice it now. And you remember our study from Phanerosis started off with Brother Thomas pointing out that the old man cannot be converted. He says, AB can. So AB is me. But my old man cannot be converted. He can only be destroyed and has to be replaced by a new man. So the person who goes around saying, I will push flesh under, I will suppress all my natural tendencies and thereby become righteous, is trying to convert the old man. You can't convert him, you sacrifice him. And if you don't sacrifice him now, then he will be sacrificed by the Lord when he comes. But he's got to be sacrificed. He's got to be destroyed. He's got to be cut off. So we can do it morally now. We can do it mentally now. But don't let us think that we can push it under any more than people can prove that if you just suppress flesh during the millennium, that it's going to make it good. Because it won't. Some will heed, but the dragon representing flesh in its natural manifestation will not. Well, I did guarantee we were going to finish Revelation 20. Well, we're not going to read all of Eureka, so that's one consoling feature. Let's come on then to the second section on page 663, where Brother Thomas comments about the key and the chain. He points out that the word abusus, which is the English word abyss, you can see it there, A-B-U-S, we get the English word abyss from that, is rendered in the English version by the fancy phrase bottomless pit. The 70, that's the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, they render the Hebrew word, whatever that is, tzula, deep, by abyss in Isaiah 44, verse 27. The great sea or aggregation of nations acknowledging the sovereignty of Babylon. For like reasons, abyss, in the prophecy before us, is representative of the aggregate of the nations occupying the dragon section of the inhabited earth. Now, those last three lines are the summary of what the word abyss is. The abyss is representative of the aggregate of the nations occupying the dragon section of the inhabited earth. So if you feel like underlining anything, you could sort of underline those three lines as being the summary. And what does that mean? The abyss in the prophecy before us is representative of the aggregate of the nations occupying the dragon section of the inhabited earth. Well, in Revelation chapter 20, we were told that I saw an angel coming down from heaven having the key of the abyss. And he uses this key to unlock the abyss, chain up the old serpent, and lock him there in that abyss. Verse 3, he cast him into the abyss and shut him up and set a seal upon him. And he tied him up there for 1,000 years and then let him out. So what was it he locked him up in? Well, as Daniel says, he took away the dominion, but he allowed his life to be extended. So in taking away the dominion of this dragon power, he just treats him as the rest of the nations. And so he stands as a symbol for flesh, as it was manifested in the old pagan system, now in a modern system, but finding itself spread out amongst the nations. Stripped of power, so that in that sense, he's cast into the abyss. the abyss and the prophecy before us is representative of the aggregate of the nations occupying the dragon section of the inhabited earth. So he's simply cast out into the nations, stripped of his political power, and thereby, in that sense, chained. So the abyss simply represents the sea of nations of the millennial age. No problems with that? I'll just try and repeat those questions because I realise the people at the back can't see. Does the dragon section cover more than just the European territory? Brother Thomas suggests in this section that it covers the territory of Gog and Magog. In other words, Europe. In fact, he probably goes a little bit further than I'd be prepared to go in some of this matter that he lists here by actually drawing on the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and pointing out that when Lazarus was in Abraham's bosom and the rich man was was it hell? Where was he?
Hades,
yes. And there was a great gulf fixed between them. Brother Thomas takes that and he says, well, that place where the rich man was,